Another measure to move us toward nuclear disarmament should be an agreement among all five of the nuclear weapons powers not to use or threaten to use nuclear weapons against non-nuclear weapon states, particularly those without nuclear weapons or troops of a nuclear weapons power on their territory. To some of us, this may seem like a modest proposal, but no, national leaders have made it into a task so difficult that the United States has yet to propose it. Such a step would free all parts of the world from nuclear warfare, except the territories of the nuclear weapon states, Europe and South Korea. These are the areas where nuclear weapons are stationed. But it would be a major step toward persuading other countries to decide not to make nuclear weapons. The third part of my overall plan that we can do now on disarmament is a scaling down by the United States of its conventional armaments production and sales. This will have to be followed by similar action by the other leading producing powers, the Soviet Union, France, Great Britain, and China. This fiscal year, we will spend up to $28 billion for the development and procurement of conventional weapons. Our government will also sanction sales of about $10 billion of weapons to the Middle East and elsewhere. We should urge our government to cut our budget for these fighter bombers, reconnaissance planes, tanks, and similar weapons. This in itself would be incentive to weapons industries to transfer capital and resources to other pursuits. If only $3 billion a year for 5 years could be cut from the billions spent for these so-called conventional weapons, this also would be a significant accomplishment. In addition to cutting our own budget for new sophisticated conventional weapons, we can put teeth into President Carter's objective to cut arms sales. We can move from a level of $10 billion in annual sales to $8 billion, $6 billion, and ultimately to only several million to be sold abroad for the legitimate security needs of other countries. These disarmament measures to reduce strategic nuclear delivery vehicles, nuclear weapons, and conventional weapons production and sales abroad would, if adopted, effectively stop the arms race. But it would not bring about comprehensive disarmament. We would still be supporting an armed forces establishment of almost 4 million persons. We would be taking only about $12 to $14 billion from our defense budget for fiscal 1978. In other words, 12 to 14 out of some $116 billion. In other words, stopping the arms race is one thing. Achieving comprehensive disarmament is something else. But what I have suggested to you could all be done now because there are no verification problems, and with the real will, we could do it safely and without jeopardizing our security at all. Are these all the measures that can be achieved? Well, for the short run, I would say if we could do this much now, we would have done more to enhance our national security and the security of other nations since the end of World War II. But more can be done and must be proposed. The world, however, must evolve into new systems of international security, new ways for states to maintain internal order with social justice and economic well-being for their citizens. To you today would create momentum toward a new world security order, and that is what we most need. Can women be the vital element in realizing these goals? Why not? Why not? With few exceptions, men make the decisions to go to war, to produce weapons, to divert our taxes. We have been largely excluded. As private citizens and as members of private organizations, we can raise our voices, do our homework, argue the case against massive weapons building, and place our money and our votes for those willing to display moderation and restraint and to support initiatives, including stepped-up negotiations to reach these relatively modest ends. Above all, we women must not be deterred because some with more power wish to discourage us and dominate the field. And let us not be dissuaded when many declare that no disarmament is possible because we face a dangerous and intractable adversary in the Soviet Union. Soviet people have suffered from war and hardship more than we have. Many millions of Soviet civilians were killed in World War II. Neither Soviet leaders nor Soviet citizens want that to happen again. Moreover, we still have plenty of weapons to protect us. We in the Soviet Union can agree not to fight and instead cooperate towards solving the world's problems, at the same time admitting that we do not like each other's political and economic systems. Our two countries are essential partners in building a more peaceful world. We must distinguish what action we can safely take by ourselves, what action we must have the Soviet Union as a partner, and what measures must await concurrence by several other countries. But only if we act can the world be saved from the catastrophe of a nuclear war. Only if we speak will our representatives in Congress work with the President to curtail and ultimately eliminate the weapons. Only if we organize together and with those of our menfolk who believe as we do, can we make the difference in diverting billions from arms to building our society into a more just and even greater democratic country. Thank you.
Wonderful and very, very exciting. I must say the frustration is that so often when women come to talk to legislators, they think that the reason we're there is we don't have the stomach for war and they should protect us from our own weakness. And I think your thing about being prepared and knowing the facts and coming in and present them very objectively is absolutely excellent. And we all have some homework to do. Yvonne, we're going to start out questioning. Do you have any questions for the panel? This is Congresswoman Yvonne Burke, who I must say, you very often get a chance to really commend a colleague, but she is one fantastic individual. She is not afraid of anything. She takes them all on, and she always has her ducks in a row and her facts behind her. So I can't commend her enough. We're really honored to have her on this panel. This is not her specialty, but she works hard in everything because she really cares about everything. And there's not a whole lot of people in the Congress like that. So if we had more like Yvonne, we'd probably have a better world. And Yvonne, will let you lead off the questioning.
Thank you very much, Pat. It's true. I'm not a member of the Armed Services Committee, and most of the work that I do is in the whole question of military assistance and foreign aid, which is a whole different sort of issue that we face. But I think that the thing that's troubling many people today, and this whole question of nuclear proliferation, is that we know that we're faced with some hot spots in the world. And these hot spots are places where there has developed tremendous tension. What I really fear is that at any time we might be faced with some of the countries who have newly acquired nuclear capability and who are not parties to the Nuclear Proliferation Treaty, who would make a decision that they felt that their own little bailiwick was more important than what could be the ultimate result of their nuclear conflict. And I say this because, quite frankly, I believe that South Africa, if faced with the possibility of extinction and faced with the possibility of purchasing from some of our allies the nuclear capability, especially considering the fact of their reserves of uranium, that they would be in a position strategically to offer to the world, might do anything. And I think that there are other places, too, and there are other spots in this world where we're faced with those same kinds of conflict. Now, what I'd like to really get some idea from some of the members of the panel is, what can we do to pressure some of our allies so that we can have some means of stopping this now before it gets closer to a reality?
The Non-Proliferation Treaty, the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty, which was negotiated in the United Nations during the 1960s, contains a clause that says the United States and the Soviet Union will undertake in good faith, and those words are in there, to reduce their nuclear arsenals, as a counterpart commitment to the commitment of other countries not to get any nuclear weapons. And for 10 years, those other countries have been pressing the United States, talking in the United Nations. There have been speeches by their political leaders that if these two superpowers don't negotiate in good faith and start showing that they are going to wind down, they set a model and a precedent and a sort of approach to foreign policy that is going to be followed by other countries. They're going to go ahead and get those weapons if we don't stop our part. And I think that this is the most important thing we can do.
Well, I see it as coming from Australia, where we have an awful lot of uranium as well. And our uranium, if we sell it, will be used to fuel reactors throughout third world countries, and almost certainly they'll be making bombs. I agree with Randy that the rest of the world looks to this country. They look to Russia but can do nothing about it. But they look to America. They admire America. They're slightly scared, but they if America could start disarming and get and eliminating her nuclear weapons and got rid of her nuclear power plants, which is the very first step. Then everybody else would say, my God, Americans must be pretty scared of nuclear power. Perhaps we're on the wrong track. But you see, America hasn't got a moral leg to stand on when it says, we've got the weapons and we've got the nuclear power plants and we know how to look after them, but you're not to have any. Other countries don't take that. They say, who are they? So it has to start in this country, the greatest power the world's ever known, a working democracy. You've got to rise up, find out what the scientists and the politicians have done to your world, and start saving it.
You want to ask a question, and then I'll come back.
I was just trying to think of something that we might all walk out of here with a shopping list of what we ought to know about before we face the next session of Congress in January, because I think one of the things we're hoping is that all of you will do some reading over the next couple months, and I know many of you already have. But I came up with some sort of a list, and I hope maybe some of the rest of you can add to it. Some of the things that I hope everyone in this room understands thoroughly would be the MX missile, what it means. That is the updating of our land-based missiles, which is an important part, supposedly, of our triad system. That's the ones that delivers nuclear bombs from the land missiles. And the MX missile will be debated in the Congress coming up, and I think you all ought to be fully aware of it, what it means and where it's going. SALT. I would think that everyone should know about SALT and where it is in the UN disarmament conference coming up in May, and what the United States position's going to be there, what we're going to do, whether we're going to just follow everyone else or whether we're going to take a leadership role. We ought to be very aware of the neutron bomb. As you know, the ball is now in the president's court as to how far we go with testing and deployment of it, and whether or not field commanders are going to have the authority to use it and so forth. Really get into the neutron bomb, understand A, what it does, B, where it will be deployed, and C, whether or not for the first time we're going to allow field commanders the right to utilize it without checking through the president, which is a very dangerous issue. Get those under, you know, absorb those and then go forward with those. Cruise missiles are going to be an issue that's ancillary to SALT and also ancillary as a follow-on discussion to the B-1 bomber discussion. And I hope everybody understands cruise missiles, what they're doing, what the implications are, and which way we're moving. I think Yvonne pointed out very well the arms sales abroad and nuclear proliferation. That would be kind of some of the major things on my homework assignment. I wanted to ask the panel if there's anything else, as we're just listing things that people should really pursue maybe in the immediate 6 months that will be coming up. Does anyone else have any ideas?
Madam Chairman, may the audience be heard from on this issue?
We will shortly. We will be opening it up shortly. At the moment, we're just doing the panel, and then we will have an hour for audience participation, if that's okay. We're just trying to review up here what we want to get our ducks in a row, and then we'll open it up to Does anyone have any further follow-on list to our homework assignment?
I don't have a follow-on to your list except for the important issue of the complete test ban to eliminate all testing. However, I think it's important to say one quick word about the MX and the danger of the MX. The important thing that you need to know is that it is to be a mobile missile. It is not a missile which would be dug in an underground shelter, but it's one that would be loaded on, someone has said in Washington, in the metro system, or on railroad cars, and would be scooted back and forth across the country. It is not verifiable by national means of inspection. So the idea of being able to verify whether countries had mobile missiles or not is not within our technical capabilities, and I think it has enormous implications for arms control agreements and that you should be aware of them. I also would have hoped you might have said something about how can Congress get more into the act on such things as reducing arms sales abroad, on proceeding with a complete test ban, on going forward with SALT negotiations, and so on. I think it's terribly important that Congress, which has been playing a more assertive role, continue to do so and have the information at its disposal that will enable it to do so.
I'd just like to add to that about there is a new SALT treaty that's being negotiated right now, a second treaty. And a fight is shaping up in Congress over this treaty, just like the fight comparable to the fight over the Panama Canal business. And unless the congressmen and women who support this new treaty and who are behind Carter's negotiating position get a lot of public support, there is some danger that this treaty can be pushed in the background by people who are opposed to any sort of control. So it's very important that there be public support of the treaty.
I see it as a mass movement like we've had in Australia about uranium. I see, first of all, you've got to find out about nuclear power plants and start eliminating them in this country so they'll be eliminated in the rest of the world so they won't play small nuclear wars. Number one. Number two, you've got to just see that in event of nuclear war, MX bombers or Tridents or whatever, you'll all be wiped out. You've got to start marching in the streets in huge numbers so the politicians see that you're alarmed and they think, my God, if I don't get into this, I won't be elected next time.
That's great.
There's just one additional thing that I think that Dr. Kahn touched on, and that was in the conversion, approach to conversion, that to me this is a very difficult subject, and I say that because I come from California where we do have a tremendous space industry, a tremendous defense industry, and there's often a feeling that people have that their futures are in jeopardy when you have a cutback on a defense system. Now, do you think that there is a real possibility of moving to a point of where you have a limitation on the percentage of defense contracts any particular company our major industry could have, because it seems to me this would have many different implications. For one thing, you wouldn't have an industry, a particular company and an area that was impacted by a defense weapon, because one weapon in many instances can have tremendous economic implications. And I think this whole idea of economic conversion and having set aside in any defense contractor a part of that company that is involved in peacetime development is very important if we're going to talk about conversion. But I hope that we can come forward and discuss this more so that we can come up with some very specific proposals that you've started listing.
I would like just to make one brief comment on this. First, I entirely agree with you that we have to take action to convince companies, communities, and workers that you can have economic conversion without any problems. And as Dr. Kahn pointed out, military spending is the worst way to create employment. There are many more important, effective ways to do it. And may I just for the moment tell you about a little pamphlet we've just come out with called Prosperity Without Guns. And it is now available and it attempts to muster all the arguments and the ways in which we can work in our own communities and with our own workers and with the company people in order to have real diversification and not have any companies dependent so much on armed spending that they have to constantly lobby with the Congress so as never to reduce the military budget. This pamphlet is available through the Institute for World Order in New York City, and I'd be happy to give further information to anyone who wants it.
I just want to add to what Randy said about the importance of having widespread public support for SALT, for the upcoming SALT treaty. Clearly, we need to have working men and women not be afraid of arms control agreements or unilateral arms control actions because they fear that they will lose their jobs. We have a real responsibility to be responsive to the legitimate rights of workers not to be fired because the United States is changing from a military to a civilian economy, so that the two issues of taking economic conversion seriously and also getting widespread public support behind arms control are just intimately interlinked. You can't have one without the other.
Thank you. I think that's quite a homework list, and I think if we all work on that homework list, the Congress will continue to stay involved. I think that's the trick, is not to let them walk away from this difficult issue. Let me tell you where we are now. Margaret Mead has to leave, and so we'll have to have her speak at 11:30, and I'm sure we're all dying to hear what she has to say. I think what we'll do is proceed right away with the people from the national groups. They'll each just take a few minutes to tell us what their groups are doing. Then we'll have Margaret Mead talk to us and give her perspective as she's been sitting patiently down there in the front row. And then we'll open it up for audience participation. So if we can now start through the groups that are up here. They're sitting over by Yvonne. Would each of you like to just introduce yourself and briefly say what you're about? Or why don't you just do that, and we'll just go down the row. How does that sound? We'll just, and when one finishes, go to the next and just each take a few minutes, so we don't get too far behind.
My name is Peggy Carlin. I am a vice president of the United Nations Association of the United States of America. I've been given 4 minutes before I came here to tell you in 4 minutes what national organizations, voluntary associations, and particularly youth groups are doing on the topic of disarmament in this country. So before I go into telling you what other organizations are doing, let me briefly explain what the organization I represent is all about. I'm sure some of you are familiar with UNA USA. Others may not know what the United Nations Association of the United States of America is supposed to be doing and is doing. We are a national, non-governmental, non-profit, non-sectarian, non-political organization. That's a lot of nons. With some 200 chapters throughout the country. One is here right in Houston. There's a Texas division of the United Nations Association. We have, which is almost more important, 150 national organizations affiliated with us, such as the League of Women Voters, the YMCA, the YWCA, the American Association of University Women, Lions International, the National Council of Women, the National Council of Negro Women, the National Council of Jewish Women, and so on and so forth, 150 of those types of organizations. Now, the purpose of all this togetherness is to acquaint the American people with the work of the United Nations. What the UN is doing. We do this by publishing a number of materials. We have published some on disarmament, such as controlling conventional weapons and halting the spread of nuclear weapons. And this, and I think I've now taken about 40 seconds, is approximately what UNA USA is all about. Now, in preparation of the United Nations special session on disarmament, we have undertaken a nationwide campaign in conjunction with the Institute of World Order. And this campaign is, and please note, because it's going to be increasingly important, Operation Turning Point. Operation Turning Point. This national campaign will include media. Television spots have already gone to television stations all over the country. We were extremely lucky to have our beloved Margaret Mead featured in one of these television spots. The others feature Paul Newman and Norman Cousins. They have gone to television stations, and we would urge you, if you are not seeing them on your local station, to please inquire why, because the station has got those spots. There are also print ads giving copy of the general campaign. Now, I don't want to do a show and tell in my 4 minutes, but I do want to hold up three very important parts of this Operation Turning Point campaign. One is the booklet called I Want to See 2000, and that addresses itself directly to what we have already heard. If we are not around in the year 2000, certainly we would like our children to be around, and we'd like them to be healthy, non-radiated, looking forward to a healthy and happy and constructive and productive life. And Operation Turning Point gives you a talking point to that fact. Another one is At the Turning Point. This is a leaflet that is very comprehensive and gives the United Nations activities in the field of disarmament and arms control. It gives citizens' actions, suggestions. It's a comprehensive leaflet that can be distributed at meetings, panel discussions, conferences, and so forth. And the third, equally as important, is why should nuclear weapon tests be stopped? Very important. It has just been published by the Center for Defense Information, the Task Force for the Nuclear Test Ban, and the United Nations Association of the United States. All these leaflets are in the Operation Turning Point material, which I'm holding up right here. It also has a discussion guide, action guide, a simulation action for disarmament, and so on. Now, let me just quickly tell you what other organizations are up to.
Time is up, I fear. Are we almost done?
Well, perhaps in discussion and question, I can bring out the action of other organizations.
Thank you very much. I'm sorry. Would the next one, please? Again, I feel like a Marine drill sergeant up here with my stopwatch. Forgive me.
I didn't have one of these, so I came up here. I'm Joe Pomerantz. I represent the Americans for Democratic Action at the United Nations. But today I'm going to talk about activities of all the legislative groups, just briefly. Now, we've heard the problem, and one thing that makes it perhaps not as searing a picture as it really is that we know that in the democratic system, we do have some machinery which we should use in order to rectify the situation. Of course, we can agree that this system doesn't always fulfill its function and doesn't always work. But any explanation for this failure must emphasize the non-participation of all of us. Certainly, the absence of an adequate citizens' political action lobby has allowed the special interests, the unwarranted interests of the military-industrial complex, as President Eisenhower said, to gain undue control. It remains for us, for an informed public, alerted to the threat of nuclear catastrophe, to develop a broad constituency, as all these speakers have urged, in support of efforts by this administration and by Congress to limit the arms race and lessen the risk of nuclear war. Women, traditionally the guardians of the family, the civilizers of the world, as one speaker called them, could be particularly effective at this task. They have a great deal at stake. Lobbying activity in Washington through established organizations is one of the most effective means available to us to promote congressional action on arms control. This area of legislation includes moves to cut the defense budget, plans for conversion designed to employ workers and resources released through defense cuts by using them in social programs, urgently needed by a peacetime economy, introduction of resolutions advocating arms control measures, and finally, ratification of arms control treaties negotiated through the United States Arms Control and Disarmament Agency. An outstanding group working in this field today is the Coalition for a New Foreign and Military Policy, with a membership of more than 50 organizations, including the National Council of Churches, the United Automobile Workers, the Friends Committee on National Legislation, Americans for Democratic Action, women's peace groups, which will be on this program following me, and others. Another is the Task Force for the Nuclear Test Ban, an ad hoc group which some of us connected with this program formed in 1971. National Organization of Women tells me they are prepared to work in this field. The American Federation of Scientists and the Arms Control Association are also leading groups working in this area. How do these organizations function? For one thing, they promote congressional resolutions advocating legislation by supplying concerned congressmen with material and evidence of public support. For example, it was a result of a request which originated with the Task Force for the Nuclear Test Ban that Senator Muskie, chairman of the Senate Subcommittee on Arms Control, undertook to hold hearings on this question in 1971.